Hello again, I'm Warren Olney. When public school teachers in West Virginia threatened a strike, the Republican governor, Jim Justice, called them dumb bunnies. He offered a 1% annual raise for the next 5 years. But with inflation likely at 2% every year, that would have been a pay cut. The New York Times says the teachers were mad as hell. They walked out. 9 days later, they came back after the governor signed a one-time raise of 5% effective this year. Teachers in other states have been paying attention. In Arizona, they walked out for 5 days. Christine Marsh teaches English at Cactus Shadows High School. 2 years ago, she was Arizona's Teacher of the Year. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us why you went out and what you got.
Well, the teachers took a statewide vote, and 78% of the teachers voted to walk out. So we walked out because I think we are tired of seeing our students and ourselves, but mostly our students, face the consequences of underfunded schools, underfunded public schools. We got $260-ish dollars per student added to the base funding out of it. So we did not get all of our what we wanted met, but we definitely moved the needle here in Arizona in the right direction for the first time really since the recession.
Were you motivated in part by what happened in West Virginia?
Yes, I think we all were. I think it was a wake-up call for teachers here in Arizona to recognize that we could indeed do something about it, even though I think all of us considered a walkout to be quite drastic. We saw that, you know, we saw it happening there and then also in Oklahoma, and I think that was probably the final catalyst that motivated teachers to do what we did.
We heard that in West Virginia, part of it had to do with salaries. Was that also true in Arizona?
Yes, that was one of our five demands. We are paid second to last in the nation for high school teachers, and we have the lowest salaries for elementary school teachers in the nation. We can't keep teachers in the classroom. We have a vacancy as of December. I'm sure it's higher now. As of December, we had 2,000 vacancies in the state, which is roughly 60,000 kids sitting in classrooms without an actual certified teacher. So, yeah, salaries were definitely part of it because we can't keep teachers in the classroom here in Arizona.
What about being Teacher of the Year? And did that give you a leadership position when it came to this action?
I wouldn't say I had a leadership position in this one, no. This was purely, this was 100% grassroots. So I think perhaps on my own campus and in my own district, but really this was the mass of teachers rising up and taking action on behalf of themselves and their students.
Tell us about your district, the Cactus Shadows High School District. That's a wonderful name for those of us who don't live in the desert.
Yeah, it's a wonderful school, lots of parental support. We live, it's situated in a rather conservative community, which made a lot of us a little bit nervous about walking out. You know, we have to walk that tightrope between making sure that our students' needs are met and yet not angering the voters enough to not pass bonds and overrides and things like that in the future. So, and I think that was probably statewide. Teachers were weighing that, but I think probably even more so in the really conservative, more rural areas, which is where I teach.
And do you feel, you said that the parents are supportive, but are there others who aren't? Is that why you're so worried that you might not get bond issues and other kinds of support in the future?
Yes. Yeah. There's a high population of non-parents. so while the parents and, you know, the immediate community was rather supportive of this, at least, you know, they were to me. I got email and, you know, ran into a parent down at the Capitol of a student of mine who was so happy to see me there. But I know the broader community was not very supportive of this action. And yes, that places us in a precarious situation moving forward. Because in Arizona, we rely on bonds and overrides.
Are you worried about backlash from the legislature?
Yes and no. Yes, I am worried. However, I am not worried in the sense that I think we are going to be making some significant changes in the legislature in November.
So a lot depends on the election coming up then.
Correct. It does.
All right. We'll come back to Christine Marsh, a teacher of the year in Arizona at the Cactus Shadows High School in 2016 as we go forward. But first, let me introduce Michael Hansen, and let me do it with this introduction. Arizona and West Virginia are hardly alone. We heard the term grassroots being used a moment ago by Christine Marsh, and that's been apparently what's happening for a long time, and it's been building since the years of George W. Bush. Michael Hansen is director of the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. Michael, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about how this has been building up since the days of No Child Left Behind.
Well, we could say that this has been building up in two different ways. One is on the education policy side. There has been increasing pressure for teachers to perform. First, from the days of No Child Left Behind, we've had school accountability policies put into place all across the country. And, of course, many of your listeners will know that these increase the focus on standardized test scores and things like high school graduation rates. And so they have really changed the environment, the working environment for many teachers in the classroom. And so they feel like there is much more of a need to perform, more so than what they've historically had in the past, which was very much an autonomous profession for a long time. And so what started initially under George W. Bush as some policies focused on schools and largely the lowest performing schools under Obama and Secretary Arne Duncan, that morphed into a focus on not just schools, but on teachers themselves. And so Secretary Duncan promoted quite a few different initiatives that were focused on great teachers and leaders. I feel like the general thrust was well placed because there's a lot of strong evidence that says teachers are important contributors to student outcomes. However, many of these states, they started putting evaluation systems into place that perhaps were a little bit ahead of the research, and in doing so, many teachers across the country have felt greater pressure to perform, and they feel like they have it has been building into a narrative that many have described as a war on teachers, and many teachers do not feel respected, and they do not feel that they are being treated as professionals as they used to be. So that's sort of the education policy side, which teachers feel they're under attack. And there's also this financial side where they've also felt under attack. And this is great recession-induced reductions in education funding for many states. Of course, many states had to cut their budgets in order to deal with the revenue shortfalls from the recession. And there are quite a few states, Arizona, Oklahoma, and North Carolina included, that went to the point of actually promoting or enacting tax cuts that essentially took temporary spending cuts in education and made them effectively permanent.
So you said other states, in addition to the ones we've heard about, which states? And are there likely walkouts going to happen, do you think, later this year?
Well, so far what we've seen is, of course, West Virginia and Arizona, as we've talked about. Oklahoma has seen strikes, and that has now mostly been resolved. But we've also seen actions in Kentucky. They weren't striking over salaries, but over proposed changes to the pension system. We've also seen recent actions in Colorado. And now next Wednesday, there is a planned walkout and day of protest in North Carolina. And so we've seen it now in six different states, and it's possible that we may see other states joining the action moving forward. However, we are nearing the end of the school year, and perhaps some of the interest and the critical mass may fade.
You mentioned two major sources of difficulty. One, the policy issue and the focus due to accountability and a sort of criticism of the teaching profession that's gone along with that, and also the financial issue. Do they complement one another? Do they sort of work together? Do people say, oh, those teachers aren't worth it anyway, so let's not pay them?
You know, that's a great question, but I don't feel like that is something that has really been articulated very much. Rather, I feel like these have been two things that were on the education policy side. I feel like the Duncan administration's policies were well-intended and were trying to promote greater access to effective teachers for all students. And on the financial side, I believe that states have been, for the most part, trying to do their best with the limited amount of resources they have. Now, the problem here, of course, is that you have a public that has begun to be resistant to increases in taxes. So the question was, should we be paying teachers, and are these two things one and the same?
Okay, exactly. Do they feed on each other?
In my opinion, these two forces, the economic or the education policy side and the financial side, I feel like these have been playing out concurrently, though I don't feel like they are directly related. On the education policy side, it has been, I feel like, well-intended attempts to try to increase access to effective teachers for all students. And on the spending side, it feels like mostly this has been most associated with the 2010 Republican takeover of many state houses that have been able to keep the cap on public education spending in many states, and also has been able to lower taxes. Not that Republicans are anti-public education per se, but I feel like they tend to have a more austere look at education spending in general.
Let me go back to Christine Marsh once again in Cactus Shadows High School in Arizona. Do you see a connection between the two? Have you felt as a result of No Child Left Behind and later the Obama administration's thrust as far as teacher performance was concerned and accountability, has that been something that has caused unease in Arizona, either on the part of teachers themselves or on the part of people who pay their salaries, the taxpayers?
I think yes on both parts. And for teachers, I think that it's counterintuitive. Everybody, you know, right now in the country, and certainly in regards to education, everything comes back to, like, we need more competition. And in reality, that's really not the life of a teacher. Like, we want to have open sharing and collaboration. And once you introduce competition, which came about really through Race to the Top, it's really not in the best interest of kids. Like, I think the intent was good. I agree with the sentiment that Arnie Duncan, they were probably trying to do something positive, but the results are not positive, where you don't want to create that kind of an environment in a school where teachers feel protective of their own material and don't want to share. I mean, as you know, we can't meet the students' needs as well as we can if we can share and collaborate, and are very much encouraged to do that.
Michael Hansen, back to you. We're talking about politics when we talk about Republicans taking over so many legislatures and governorships. A moment ago, Christine Marr said that in Arizona, the teacher rebellion, if that's the appropriate term, was 100% grassroots. It was not led by anybody. Is that true in other states? Are teachers' unions then not necessarily involved in this?
That's a great question, and this is something that has been different across the various states that we've seen it play out. The strike, the original strike in West Virginia, I would say it played out more or less consistently with what we expect of a union-led kind of strike. I mean, it wasn't exactly a textbook union strike, but it was pretty close. There was a couple of days where teachers, even though the unions didn't wanted to go back to class, the grassroots movement, if you will, did want to stay on strike for another day or two. But for the most part, the union led that one. But in places like Arizona, Oklahoma, the union has been taking much more of a back seat. These teacher actions are happening in mostly right-to-work states and where unions are relatively weak. And it's been teachers who are organizing through social media that have largely been getting their voices heard and getting their messaging out.
Does this has this spurred the teachers' unions? Have they tried to recruit and organize in some of these states, given what's happening?
Certainly, teachers' unions are looking to take advantage of this groundswell of interest, and they want to both control the messaging of teachers and try to make it consistent across these different groups, and then also they're trying to sway public opinion and get people on their side. So they're certainly trying to. They're in the game and they're trying to do things to be a part of it, but they're not necessarily the ones who are moving the ball in all of these states.
Michael Hansen, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, also director of the Brown Center on Education Policy. We've been listening to him and to Christine Marsh, the Teacher of the Year at the Cactus Shadow High School in Arizona. And also listening patiently has been Laura Bartlett. She is an associate professor of education at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And she's also author of a book that raises a subject that I think many of us simply don't know about, and that is Migrant Teachers. That's the name of the book, Migrant Teachers, How American Schools Import Labor. Professor Bartlett, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
What are we talking about, importing teachers?
Sure. Well, it's interesting that Michael Hansen talked about the way No Child Left Behind changed the policy landscape, because one of the things it insisted on is that school districts hire well-qualified teachers, and they defined well-qualified as subject specialism in particular. And school districts that had a historically hard time at attracting and retaining well-qualified teachers didn't suddenly overnight change their pay, working conditions, or respect for teachers' work. So they found themselves suddenly needing to produce these teachers that met the standards, but not having a clear supply. And places like the Philippines, from whom we've long been recruiting nurses, presented themselves as places where we could source teachers. And we began to see a big rise in teachers coming in, mostly from developing countries, into the United States just after No Child Left Behind. Between 2002 and 2008, almost 100,000 teachers came into the United States to teach on mostly short-term labor visas, but also cultural exchange visas.
And you say that they need to have subject specialties. Are they better qualified than the people available then in the states that hire them?
Better qualified is a difficult question. I mean, the teachers who are recruited have been teachers in their home countries. If we take the Philippines, for example, the teachers who are recruited have to have a degree, have to have a credential certification from their home country, and they have to have been teaching at least 5 years. And when they're coming in, they must pass the relevant state tests to teach in those districts and complete their credential. So they're certainly qualified to teach by the definition of subject specialism and pedagogical preparation. And they're often coming into school districts where half or more of the teachers prior to No Child Left Behind were not fully credentialed to teach in the areas they were teaching. So they're more qualified in terms of their professional preparation than the unqualified folks who preceded them, but they're not more qualified than well-qualified American teachers.
Why do they want to come here and teach?
Oh, well, in the Philippines, a teacher annual salary is about $3,000 to $4,000 a year. That's below the poverty level in the Philippines. So the opportunity to come and teach in the United States, mostly leaving their family behind in the Philippines and allowing them to send salary remittances back, allow them to live quite frugally, usually in the United States, and then support their family's housing and education in the Philippines.
And what states have the most imported labor for the purpose of teaching in public schools?
Oh, well, the states where we see the most overseas trained teachers are actually California, where we are right now, Texas, New York, though there certainly are also overseas trained teachers in places like Arizona to a much lower level. In a six-year period, about 1,300 teachers came into Arizona on H-1B visas, labor shortage visas. But those, the three big ones are really California, Texas, and New York. And they don't just come from the Philippines, by the way. Teachers are coming from Mexico into Texas. We have seats Jamaican teachers in New York, teachers from India, all over the country. But the Philippines is one of the major source countries.
Has the Trump administration had any problem with this, given its position with regard to immigration in general?
Well, I don't know that there's been any particular mention of teacher migration, but certainly the Trump administration has made a lot of noise around reducing the H-1B visa, which is the labor shortage visa that allows workers under any labor shortage category to flow into the United States. So restricting the H-1B visa will perhaps push folks more into different types of visas.
Just have to point out that we think of migrant labor in terms of agriculture in the United States, but it turns out it is a very big factor in terms of public education as well. One thing, Christine Marsh, back to you at Cactus Shadows High School that I didn't ask you before, is about salaries here. Salaries obviously are all comparative, and if people in the Philippines think it's the salaries here are worth moving that far for. What's the situation in Arizona? What do you get paid?
The average starting salary is the low 30s. So when you factor in cost of living, Arizona is like fourth from the bottom. As far as like real dollars, we're at the bottom or right above the bottom for high school teachers. We've looked at that as well, like when you factor in cost of living, because I think that's where you're going with this, right? Like, is
sure.
Starting salary is $32,033, depending on the district. And a lot of us have been frozen due to recession cuts and all of that, off and on for about 10 years. So I should be, according to the salary scale, making $12,000 a year more than I make. But people don't realize that when they look at salary schedules, it looks like teachers are pretty well paid, but we're not, because we don't follow the salary schedule anymore. We haven't, most districts haven't for about 10 years.
So you're getting less than what you're supposed to.
I personally am getting $12,000 a year less based on having 26 years of experience and a master's degree. I should be making $12,000 a year more. And when we signed up to teach, and I want to just disclaimer, I love teaching. I absolutely love it with a passion that's sometimes frightening. But we didn't sign up. Like, we looked down the road. I mean, I can remember looking and thinking, oh, okay, well, after 15 years or 20 years, I'll be making X amount of money. But that has not come to fruition for really any public school teacher in Arizona.
Is there resentment on the part of American teachers when teachers from the Philippines and Jamaica and Mexico and India come into this country?
I personally have not seen the resentment. I think because, at least in Arizona, there's such a demand for teachers that the migrant teachers are not taking anybody's jobs. So on my campus, we have teachers from China who teach Mandarin, and we have that throughout the district because my school district is very language-focused, so, world languages. So I have not seen that type of resentment. I would imagine that it does exist in some parts of the country, especially if there is a shortage of teaching jobs, but that's not the case in Arizona. We can't bring enough in. So
let me go back to Laura Bartlett again at UC Santa Cruz. You said that the places with the most imported teachers are California, Texas, and New York. Those are the biggest states in the union, and there are thought to be states that at least certainly California and New York that spend a lot of money per pupil on education. That's less and less true, I know, in California. We think of the education issues that we're talking about as being more typical of southern states and other states that traditionally have not invested a lot in education. How does it work out in terms of what states need the imported teachers and which ones don't?
I'd say it's much less state-based than it is student demographic and community-based. So while we say that we see teachers concentrated, for example, in California, overseas-trained teachers, we actually find them in just 12 of the over 1,000 school districts that exist in California. And those are the school districts where the student populations are all below the state's poverty level, below the state norm or, you know, median for English language learners that has the highest percentage of non-white students. They're the school districts that serve the neediest, highest poverty student populations in the country, is where we find overseas trained teachers. And we find them, by the way, in math, science, and special education predominantly.
Now, why is that?
Why do we find them in those areas?
Yeah.
Well, math and science are shortage areas for teachers internationally, really. The Philippines, Jamaica, those countries also have trouble recruiting math and science teachers because people in math and science have other occupational opportunities where the pay and respect is higher than in teaching. Historically, the people who have taught, of course, are women and people of color in the United States, particularly African Americans, when their labor options were limited. And as women and people of color have developed more occupational options, when pay and status is reduces, they tend to move into other occupational groups. So in many ways, migrant teachers represent another low status category of labor, if you can bring into the country. And I just want to add that they're low status within the United States, but it's this international game of chutes and ladders. In order for a teacher, for example, in the Philippines, to rise to the point in their home labor market where they can come to the United States, they have to go all the way up the ladder. They're typically teaching at the top schools. They have degrees from the best universities in the Philippines. They're well-respected. They get recruited to teach in the United States, and they get on that chute down to the very bottom of the American teacher labor market where they teach in the schools that have the highest difficulty recruiting and retaining teachers.
And they live in a very frugal way, as we heard before, because in this country, that's not that much given the cost of living here. But they can still, if they live very carefully and very frugally, they can send money home. Is that right?
Yeah, it raises really interesting questions about the professional status of teachers. Essentially, these teachers can support their families well in their home countries, provided they don't reunite with their families and bring them here. They stay here. They live, perhaps, five or six of them to a one- or two-bedroom apartment. They live as frugally as they can, and they send as much money as they can home. Once they bring their families here and have to live in the same economy in which they're working, they no longer can sustain that standard of living. And hence, we see a situation where we're creating a dynamic where we say that for teachers to live well, they have to live outside of the labor market in which they're working. And I've had locally here, I'm in Santa Cruz. It's a very high cost area to live in. And in regional workforce meetings, some folks have said, well, maybe we need to hire teachers remotely from other parts of the country where it costs less to live, and they can Skype in to teach their classes and not have to live in this expensive housing market, for example. So this idea, this notion, if you will, is a challenging one for thinking about the way we know teaching and learning works best in schools.
Christine Marsh, back to you. You're a teacher. Tell us about that. What would be the consequences if teachers were, in fact, teaching remotely, as apparently people are suggesting?
Oh, that's a horrible idea.
Yes.
I mean, on a large scale, because any good teacher knows that the most important aspect of teaching, especially, you know, high school and elementary, I'm not talking college level, obviously, but the most important aspect is the relationship that a teacher has with his or her children. And remotely, that boils it down to academics only, which is going to work for some kids, probably going to work for a lot of kids, but it is not going to work for a lot of kids who need that, you know, attention from a teacher. I mean, students who like their teachers will perform at a higher level. I mean, the research bears that out. I would be very opposed to that on any kind of a large scale. With acknowledging that it does work for some kids. I mean, we have an online portion of our campus here as well. I mean, and that works for that handful of kids who, for whatever reason, function better in that environment. But the vast majority of kids need that relationship with a teacher.
Let me just go back to Michael Hansen for a moment. Again, at the Brown Center at the Brookings Institution, we just heard that so often historically, it's been women and people of color who have been our teachers. If there is, in fact, the kind of grassroots movement that we're hearing about today, is that part of what we've been seeing, the Me Too movement and the concern about race politics?
There is certainly some element of women's movement that's helping to propel the interest in striking among teachers, because we know teachers are 3/4 female, and also they are disproportionately white. And so it doesn't necessarily fall neatly along the lines of necessarily empowering or sort of speaking to the racial elements, because it is a disproportionately white profession. However, historically, black teachers were more likely to participate, but now currently they don't as much because their outside opportunities have increased. And I would argue that it appears that because we don't pay teachers on average, we don't pay them as well as we do other similarly educated full-time workers in the economy, that often what this requires is that the teachers who are showing up to work are those like Christine here, who are very motivated and very dedicated to the profession, and often it also requires that they have another person in their home who's helping to pay the bills, because more often than not, for people who are the only wage earner in their homes, being a teacher is just not a sustainable profession.
Christine Marsh, I understand that you are not only the former Teacher of the Year at the Cactus Shadows High School in Arizona, but also a candidate for the state Senate. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Are you running on an education issue or platform?
I am primarily, yes, I'm definitely running on an education platform, but I'm also a former foster mother, and that's not the only issue, but it's the catalyst and the most important one for me.
Michael Hansen, do you see other teachers moving into politics as this movement develops?
Certainly. I've seen stories of teachers in Oklahoma who, after protesting in the state capitol, they go then and file their papers with the clerk's office to put their names on the ballot for the state legislature as well. So Christine is not the only person who is agitating for change and wants to be a part of that change. But I don't think it's just going to be happening through teachers going into public office, but this is also happening. What we're seeing in terms of the teacher strikes and the larger actions and the discussions, these are creating a situation where everybody is paying attention. Education leaders, superintendents, they are paying attention, as well as union organizers, of course, across the country. And so when they next come to the bargaining table, everyone is going to be keying off and making strategies in line with what they believe the other side is going to be doing in this context of unrest about pay. And then also, of course, as Christine mentioned, we always have the ballot box, and particularly in states where funding has not resumed to levels that it was at the beginning of the recession, or where teachers have been getting the short end of the stick for perhaps a few years too long, then these kinds of actions send the message that teachers, that voters should be making a change.
Laura Bartlett, back to you at UC Santa Cruz. Your book is Migrant Teachers, How American Schools Import Labor. Has that become a political issue anywhere? Have people looked at that and said, wait a minute, we ought to be able to train our own teachers. We don't need to get them from the Philippines.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, it's come up much more recently now that there are so many labor actions happening with teachers. But the thing to remember is that the overseas trained teachers, once they arrive here, are teachers in American schools. They join our unions. They're part of the teacher labor market in the U.S. And we have a decision to make. We can either transplant them and make them a permanent part of the schools they join, or what most schools are doing right now is treating them as transient labor. And as transients, they have a limited agency and ability to do the kind of important contributions to teacher student learning that they're interested in doing. Just like Christine, they are incredibly dedicated to student learning. And they went into teaching for many similar reasons. And economic imperatives pushed the Filipino teachers to leave their home country, often at great personal loss. But their commitment to teaching students remains and comes with them to the United States. The issue is that when the strikes happen, actually, those teachers are in an even more vulnerable position than our American teachers, because their visas are dependent on them continuing to work. So when they strike, and they do strike along with our teachers for improved working conditions for teachers' work with students, they risk not only their lost salary, but they risk not being able to stay in the country anymore. So I think that once they're here, we really should think of them as teachers, just like the rest of our teachers, and be working to incorporate them more successfully into the schools.
Michael Hansen, we talked a bit about Arne Duncan and about the Bush administration as well, and the two subsequent administrations or successive administrations focusing on accountability and so on. What about Betsy DeVos, the current Secretary of Education, and what impact has she had on all of this?
Secretary DeVos, I would say, if anything, has largely continued to play into the narrative of a war on teachers. And she has, notably very early on with the Senate confirmation process, there were several gaffes that went viral. And she has made several statements that were quite dismissive of public school teachers' professionalism and the way that public schools are operated. She is viewed with a high level of distrust among public school teachers, and I've seen polling that suggests that she is actually more unpopular than Donald Trump is among public school teachers. And that says something among this group. And so I feel like, if anything, the continued or the perceived hostility from Betsy DeVos to teachers in general is just another, another fire, log on the fire that kindles or that is getting going these teacher actions across the country.
She, of course, a woman of great wealth who never attended public schools herself and has been very active in the charter movement, which we haven't had time to talk about. Christine Marsh, very quickly, do you feel that teachers are, in fact, the enemy in a war on teachers?
Yeah. I think that the teachers are definitely under attack. I heard you use that term earlier. And yes, on a very personal level, it's not. I think people like their public school teachers, and parents are generally very supportive, but on a broader policy level, it's very much that teachers are under attack. And we feel it. We know it. We hear the quotes from the Betsy DeVos's of the world, on a local level and all of that.
Christine Marsh, high school English teacher at Cactus Shadows High School in Arizona, Teacher of the Year 2016, now a candidate for the state Senate. Michael Hansen at the Brookings Institution, he's director of the Brown Center on Education Policy. Laura Bartlett, associate professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of Migrant Teachers, How American Schools Import Labor. Thank you all.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This edition of To the Point was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer was Joel Stein. I'm Warren Olney. Now it's your turn. Take a minute to review our podcast. Rate it in Apple Podcasts. Every review helps new listeners find our conversations. Send me any suggestions or questions you might have. You can use Facebook or Twitter. I look forward to knowing what you think. You can subscribe to The Point wherever you download your podcast or listen anytime at kcrw.com/To the Point. Meantime, join us again.